Welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum,
Matt Levine,
and we're breaking down all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, anything and everything. If it's a strange beast, it's welcome at this camp. So thank you for hanging out. Gotta give a quick shout out to BanditsEmporium.com, the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju, where you can shop all sorts of monster-inspired t-shirts featuring vampires and Frankensteins and Godzilla, of course, with more to come. BanditsEmporium.com, as they say, we sell shirts. Hey, as Camp Kaiju says, they can't be everybody.
Very excited to talk about Rodan, and also want to welcome Frank, our very special guest tonight. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. Excited to talk about Rodan, which I consider to be, not to give away the part at the end where we give our ratings and everything, but I consider this to be, if not equal to, then at least like the 1B to like Godzilla and King Kong as far as giant monster movies go, and doesn't get the love that it deserves. So it's time to put some respect on Rodan's name.
I think that is so well put. Let's not talk about the end right now, because I was also about to just tell you how I feel about it. So before we get into the synopsis and the production history, everybody, just want to say thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. You can follow us on social medias. You can follow us wherever you podcast. We just are really grateful for your support and for enjoying Kaiju Lai all month long. We've been talking about classic kaiju films, mostly from Toho. And this is the capper of the month. So I think it's a good one to end Kaiju Lai on for this year. So Matt, should we go into the synopsis, or should we talk about our personal histories with this film?
Well, Frank, maybe I'll turn it over to you. And if you have a personal history with the film and like want to introduce yourself a little bit and like your sort of film background, you're more than welcome to.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as far as my film background, I'm just, you know, former film studies major, went to college with Matt and everything for some of that, which has, you know, prepared me for a career in telesales, selling welding supplies and safety supplies to businesses. So
I can relate but, to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as my background with the movie goes, though, I actually, you know, as far as kaiju movies go, I hadn't seen really a ton until a few years ago. You know, of course, I'd seen like Godzilla and some of the like big classics that kind of everyone's seen. But so Matt and I are in a like a Facebook movie group as well, where just people kind of post about what movies they've watched recently and things like that. And there's one guy in that group with us who I don't know personally, but he seems like a good guy from the group, named Todd Temperley. And he would always post about these kaiju movies. And one time several years ago, back around Halloween, Turner Classic Movies was showing a bunch of kaiju movies. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to have time to like watch every one of these, but like, I'm going to ask this Todd guy, like, which are the ones I have to see? And he kind of gave me a list. And out of those, I picked, I don't know, six or seven or whatever that I DVR'd. And of those, Rodan was definitely my favorite of the ones that I watched. Just thought it was really compelling for reasons that we'll get into here. And yeah, it just really stuck with me. So when you guys gave me the invite to come on, it was one of the first things I thought of. And I thought, well, surely you guys have already done an episode on this one. And you hadn't when I looked through the archives. So I was like, great, it's Rodan, let's do it.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Frank. My experience with the film, just from the past 2 years, honestly, I've seen it 3 to 4 times in the past 2 years. When I started this podcast, I sought it out as one of those lesser known hidden gems. And it certainly was that. And I just fell in love with it from the moment I watched it, for reasons we'll get into.
Yeah, I would just say that I was introduced to Rodan, I guess, in Ghidorah, the Three-Headed Monster, which, you know, he has like kind of a bit part in that. And it's sort of like a little bit silly, as we talked about in the episode a little while ago, as much as I love that movie. But I was not really prepared for how kind of maybe bleak is too strong of a word, but like, yeah, like serious minded this movie is at times. And I really like the, you know, the creature Rodan a lot. And I, although it's unfortunate that he never really appeared in like his own, or, you know, there are two of them in this film, but like in their own or his own standalone film after this, like, I feel like maybe what else could you do with it after this movie? Like, I feel like it's hard to improve upon, you know?
That's a good point. So with that, Frank, you're the guest of honor. You can take it away.
All right. Well, in a small mining village near the foothills of Mount Aso, two miners named Goro and Yoshi have gone missing after the mine in which they were working flooded. The men had brawled earlier that day and had some kind of ongoing feud. The mine safety engineer, Shigeru, descends into the mine to investigate and finds Yoshi's mauled corpse.
A doctor analyzes Yoshi's body and discovers that the cause of death was a number of gashes caused by a sharp object. The miners begin to suspect that Goro killed himself, but two local miners and a policeman are also attacked in the flooded mine shaft, and the wounds suggest that they were slain by whatever killed Yoshi.
That night, Shigeru and his fiance, Kyo, are attacked at their home by a Meganulon, a giant larval insect. The police start hunting the creature, and it kills two men before fleeing into the mine. The dead men's injuries suggest that the larval insect creature also committed the earlier killings. Shigeru, along with some soldiers and police officers, descend into the mine and discover Goro's corpse, then are chased by the insect monster.
Shigeru crushes the monster with a runaway minecart, but soon a second giant larva appears. The tunnel caves in, trapping Shigeru in the mine. A doctor named Kashiwagi identifies the monster as a Meganuron, an ancient species of dragonfly larva. An earthquake strikes the area and people begin to believe that the volcanic Mount Aso will soon erupt.
The police discover that the road into the mine has been blocked by damage from the earthquake. They also find Shigeru with amnesia wandering around the area. As he tries to recover his memory, a nearby airbase in Kyushu receives a report from a fighter pilot that a UFO is performing impossible aerial feats at supersonic speeds in the area of Mount Aso. The flying object soon overtakes the fighter pilot, destroying his plane and killing him. The airbase gets word that planes in Okinawa, the Philippines, and Beijing were taken down in a similar fashion.
Meanwhile, a married couple has gone missing near Mount Aso. When the police investigate the married couple's photographs from their camera, they discover a massive wing, which suggests that the flying creature is a pteranodon. Shigeru still has no memory of being trapped in the mine, but when Kyo shows him the eggs that her pet birds have laid, Shigeru suddenly remembers. In the cave, he was surrounded by hordes of Meganuron.
There's also a giant egg in the middle of the cave from which Shigeru watched a massive bird emerge. His amnesia now gone thanks to the traumatic memory, Shigeru heads back into the mine and discovers a piece of the colossal egg. Dr. Kashiwagi examines the egg and confirms that it is from a pterosaur, basically like a pterodactyl type creature, which the doctor names Rodan. He also hypothesizes that nuclear bomb testing may have awakened Rodan from its slumber.
Rodan takes flight near Mount Aso and heads toward Kyushu with planes from the Japanese Self-Defense Force hot on its tail. After one of its wings is injured, the monster flies to Fukuoka, laying waste to the city with the windstorms caused by its wings. Suddenly, a second Rodan appears to join its mate. They finish devastating the city and fly back to Mount Aso.
The military comes up with a plan to fire at the base of Mount Aso, burying the two Rodans under the rubble. They do so, instigating a volcanic eruption. The first Rodan's wing is damaged in the lava and volcanic debris. It crash lands into a pit of lava and burns alive. The second Rodan dives into the eruption, apparently unwilling to continue its path of destruction without its mate.
Ooh, yeah, that was great. I just want to mention, or I believe the pronunciation is Meganulon with an L rather than Meganuron.
We should probably apologize to anybody if there's any like Japanese listeners for all the mispronunciations there. I realized as we were reading it, I should have like looked up how to pronounce some of the stuff. But
yeah, mispronouncing Meganulon is the least of our worries with pronunciation.
Just an umbrella sorry for all of that. Yeah. It's a very tragic ending, I think, to this movie. It's a very fun movie, but it's pretty bleak, and I think we kind of definitely feel for the Rodan creatures at the end.
which is what I, when the first time I watched this movie, I was not prepared for an emotional, I cried at the end. What else could I say?
Yeah, it's very touching. I don't, you know, not to get ahead of ourselves too much, but, you know, like the end with the Rodan creatures is kind of like paralleled by Shigeru and his fiance Kyo, sort of very sadly and tearfully sort of embracing each other. And I just think it's very unexpected that the movie would kind of draw a parallel between the human characters and the two monster characters, which I think goes a long way in developing a lot of sympathy for them.
I completely agree. In the role of Shigeru is Kenji Sahara, who I love as a performer. He has appeared in more Godzilla films than any other actor.
Yeah, so we also, the movie also features Yumi Shirakawa as Kyo. She was dubbed the Japanese Grace Kelly.
We have Akihiko Hirata as Dr. Kashiwagi. He starred as the troubled Dr. Sarazawa in the original Godzilla. The director is Ishiro Honda. He directed the previous films featured on our Kaijulai Kaiju Festival, those being Ghidra, the Three-Headed Monster, and Terror of Mechagodzilla, and the music by Ikuro Ifukube. I always fall in love with his scores. Is that just me? I don't know.
Definitely one of the MVPs of these Toho era kaiju movies, for sure. And this has a particularly good one too, I think. Particularly good score by him.
I feel like we need to mention him every time because his scores are always fantastic.
They say so much. Like they just add so much character and flavor to the film. So we'll go into the production backstory. Before we do that, I will tell you all about banditsemporium.com, the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju, where you can find monster-inspired t-shirts. If you buy a t-shirt, you can support this show directly. Part of the proceeds go to us, which is very great when we're hosting guests like Frank. It costs a little bit to host this sort of stuff. So we do appreciate that support. So banditsemporium.com, as they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, Matt, what does Camp Kaiju say?
Camp Kaiju says, we talk monsters.
That's it. That's all you need to know.
Yep.
And may I just say, if you need a shirt that you can wear both on the runway and in the boardroom, the Camp Kaiju shirt is a great choice.
Ooh, there's an endorsement.
That's what we were going for. That's good to hear. I'm going to wear a Camp Kaiju shirt in the boardroom tomorrow and see how it goes. I'll report back to you guys. It may end disastrously. We'll see.
Okay, so like we said, this was the first movie to feature Rodan the monster. This was actually, not only was it the first to feature Rodan, it was the second, I believe it was the second of Toho's kaiju films. It followed Gojira from 1954. And another first, this was Toho's first film in color.
I believe you're right. And it's a very beautiful movie, I think. I love the color cinematography. It looks great.
Yeah, makes excellent use of color. And it's got the sort of beautiful, like, muted tone to it that, well, fits and helps create the ominous tone of the
movie. Definitely agree. And I, especially in contrast to Terror of Mechagodzilla, which I feel like was a little bit like dark and gray, and like there didn't seem to be a lot of attention paid to the cinematography in that movie. Like to go from that to this, there are just so many striking, really beautiful shots, which almost look like pastel a little bit, like light yellows and like light greens and stuff like that. It's just a very, very beautiful movie.
And now that we're talking about it, it is like, yeah, Frank, how do they get that color? Because to me, now that we're talking about it, it does have like a very cream tone to it.
It was filmed in Eastman color, which I know like quite a few other movies had at that time. It was processed in Far East Laboratories in Tokyo, Japan. So I don't know like if any kind of like combination of just like the processing and like the stock itself, like Frank said, like, yeah, it looks very unique. And I feel like just the convergence of those like technical like specifics really kind of lead to a very distinct look.
And coming from Gojira, which was so starkly black and white, which was really shot well in black and white. And then they move into color just as effectively.
Yeah, very impressive. So this is director Ishiro Honda's personal favorite of his own monster movies, which I thought was kind of interesting. The story is by a novelist named Ken Kuronuma, who was inspired by the death of an American pilot in Kentucky who blacked out and crashed his plane and died while pursuing a UFO in 1948. It probably was not Rodin, but who knows? Maybe it was. Take it away.
I was going to talk about the title of the film. So I don't know if you guys know this, but a trivia about the film is in Japan, it is called The Monster and the movie is called Radon. But when it was translated for American release, or at least English language release, it was the translators who switched the A and the O and titled it Rodan. Reasons for that, I don't know how much of this is factual, but radon is a radioactive material. And maybe someone made a decision to lessen the connection to the radioactive suffering that Americans inflicted on the Japanese. And you can still hear it in the film. Some of the characters still refer to the monster as Radon.
You know, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more later too, but I think the connection to, you know, the atomic bombings in Japan during World War II by the United States is kind of like evoked in some ways in this movie. Sort of like Gojira, it raises like very kind of striking like parallels to that in sort of unexpected ways. It's a very sobering theme.
Yep. Right in line with Honda and Toho's post-war messaging for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, the Rodan creatures were brought to life by a slew of scale flying models and puppets for Rodan's upper half. Four actors inhabited the massive six-legged Meganudon suit, which looks awesome. I'm sure we'll talk more about that later, but it looks so cool. And whatever actors were inside of there did a fantastic job. And yeah, I guess just the last thing about like the production backstory, this is more a little bit about the reception of the movie, but it did extremely well commercially in Japan and overseas as well in the United States. It grossed an estimated $450,000 to $500,000 during its opening weekend in the United States and remains, you know, kind of one of the more successful and popular kaiju movies outside of Japan, I think, throughout Toho's kind of creation of all these movies. So pretty impressive.
Which again makes it interesting that it didn't sort of spawn more sequels and spinoffs of its own.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe like, you know, after this point, I think in like the early 60s, they started to get maybe a little bit sillier, a little bit campier. And that's not always a bad thing. But I wonder if that's kind of what led to like the lack of Rodan prevalence in later movies, you know, because at least in this case, it's kind of like a stark character.
Yeah. And to what you said earlier, Matt, what more could you do with this character alone? I think maybe in some ways it was natural that he would just get paired off with Godzilla. Otherwise, he'd probably just be fighting his own monster enemies in his own string of films.
Which would not be a bad thing necessarily.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I guess he's maybe the least like cuddly of the kaijus, I guess. Like yeah. Like with you know, like with Godzilla, you could sort of put like a human face to Godzilla a little bit, or you know, kind of ascribe human characteristics to Godzilla a little bit that make it easy to make him like a good guy in future movies and stuff, or to have him team up with people. Whereas, yeah, Rodan's just kind of a nasty monster. So yeah, I guess maybe it's just a more limited character in that way.
That's a great point, Frank, because even this is getting into like what was established in Ghidra, the three-headed monster, the personalities of each. And you're right, Godzilla is that human hero. Mothra is all about peace and tranquility, and Rodan is the snarky one in the group. I think even in like Godzilla King of the Monsters from 2019, those the kaiju in that were not depicted anthropomorphized, but Rodan was still portrayed as like fire monster, very sharp and gritty, which is I think is in line with how we've come to think of the character.
Yeah, and I think sort of like retrospectively, maybe that's what I like about him personally so much. Like he's just mean. There's not like really like an attempt to like, yeah, like Frank said, like make him like cute and cuddly. Like he's a monster and he's like all about destruction. And yeah, and that kind of changes in the last couple minutes of the movie, but it's kind of like a refreshing purity almost, or like simplicity, you know? Like I admire the fact that he's just a monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then this one though, he's a bit of a lover too. Both of them. True. There are two.
Yeah. Yeah, did you, I mean, you know, if you guys want to bring up any themes that you noticed from the film, you can.
Well,
yeah.
I could bring up one that comes early on in the movie, are the references to global warming, or, you know, the theory of global warming, as, you know, one character says near the beginning. I remember when I first saw this back in 2019, that caught my eye right away, because I, for some reason in my head, I had thought that the whole idea of global warming wasn't really introduced until like the 70s. And, you know, this movie coming out two decades earlier, that just kind of caught my attention, because I had no idea that that was something that that was a point of discussion at that point.
First time I watched this movie, same thing caught my eye, because I was like, oh, it didn't start with Al Gore. Like, in my mind, global warming is such a recent thing. And it's like, people know, people, scientists in the 50s were talking about it. Why has this never been addressed then, if we've known about it for so long?
I feel like, you know, a lot of these early kaiju movies, Gojira certainly in this one, like, are, you know, the monsters are kind of like symbolic for man's destruction, like the destruction that humans are capable of, and obviously nuclear devastation is a big part of that, but yeah, this movie brings in global warming as well. And, you know, I feel like the movie kind of like is a little bit, it seems cynical, like, you know, early on the scientists are saying like, yeah, like if the polar ice caps melt, then the whole world would be flooded and that would be terrible. And then they just like laugh and move on. And that seems like very intentional and very like darkly satirical kind of, you know. And like, you know, now what, like 70 years later, that's even more kind of like infuriating that like, yeah, we've known about this for almost 100 years and all, you know, very little has been done about it. So it's a really effective part of this movie's thematic sort of core, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. 70 years later, that's crazy.
I think part of that too is like the fact that the Rodans might be awakened by the mining. Like, I think it's like black diamond mining, they say at one point in the movie. So I think the movie definitely tries to make a point to say that, like, you know, humanity's exploitation of the Earth's like natural resources has kind of like led us to this point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like it is like definitely seems very intentional, this like depiction of sort of callous or maybe indifferent humans not really knowing like the negative consequences of like the actions that they have, you know?
Yeah, I think humanity's effect on nature or relationship with nature, for me, is the foremost theme of the movie. The end with the creatures' deaths, it's just this sad depiction of humanity's relationship with the natural world.
Yeah, it's, you know, like I think this kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, the kind of like darker subject matter that the screenwriter, Takashi Kimura, the co-writer, I'm assuming that maybe he was responsible for bringing in some of those themes, maybe not, but in any case, this movie, like a lot of other Toho kaiju movies from this era, seems to be a lot more pointed and like pessimistic about humanity's impact on nature.
Yeah, I was just gonna add about the miners and the screenwriter's communist affiliations real quick. So in the beginning of Rodan, the miners, there's a couple miners who get into a fight and there's some sort of conflict there. Apparently there was a minor a union revolt. I'm not sure the exact details, but there was a worker uprising in that same region of Japan that Rodan is set in. So that could be some recent history that those screenwriters with their socialist leanings are trying to just touch on a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely think the movie's trying to pick up on that a little bit. And there's also a shot, or like actually an edit early on in the movie that I think is really interesting too, where we see like a bunch of mine carts kind of like moving like down and to the right through the frame as the miners are kind of like trying to figure out what happened when there's this flood early on in the movie. And that shot dissolves to like a moving shot that's like goes over the blueprints in like the engineer's office. So it's like the same kind of camera movement, but it goes from like the lower class workers to like the upper class, like engineers who are away. They're safe. They're not like endangered or anything. They're not in the mines, obviously. Mm-hmm. So like that, just the fact that that dissolves seems like very intentional, and like the same camera movement, like seems to contrast like the workers and like their overseers, like in a very kind of like, yeah, political way, like these two experiences are like totally separated, you know. Thought it was a fascinating edit. I love that moment.
There was one more I wanted to touch on, and Matt, looks like in your notes you talked about, of course, the evoking the devastation from World War II on civilians evacuating from the the monsters descending onto their cities. That made me remember Shigura's his shell shock, his amnesia. There's a scene where they're showing him pictures. They bring his fiance into the room. They're trying to jog his memory, and Sahara, the performer, it's so captivating, his performance, because he doesn't do anything extra, which as a performer can be so hard to do. Like if Matt or Frank, if I'm like, you know, act like you have amnesia, lesser, maybe not you guys, but most people might like do silly things, like look around the room, like what, where am I? But Sahara just, he has a stone face, but you can see just in his eyes that he's lost. He's lost in his own mind. And it's frightening, honestly. I was like, oh my God, this little performance that I think I mentioned in the Ghidra episode, that Honda had been in the Japanese Imperial Army himself in the 30s. So as a soldier, he probably saw that firsthand, that sort of PTSD shell shock look. And I just thought was a nice moment that I wanted to call out.
Yeah, definitely the best performance in the movie, at least the best performance of someone playing a human, for sure. He's very good in it, especially in that scene that you mentioned.
Yeah, there's kind of a touching moment when Kyo, his fiance, comes in and he doesn't seem to recognize her at all, or maybe he does, but he can't quite place her, you know. It's really effective. And again, I think like kind of like the love story between them, even though it's not really touched on all that much. And then the, I don't know, relationship seems like a strong word, but like the two Rodan creatures and how they kind of go down in flames together. Like, I just feel like pairing the human story and the Rodan story works pretty well. It makes it a little bit more emotional than I thought it would be.
Yeah, there's a lot of care taken in those emotional moments that I think elevates this movie above just a run-of-the-mill monster movie.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's I admire like the thematic ambition of this movie, which again, like that's a big part of Gojira and why I love Gojira so much, and crops up in some of the other kaiju movies. But yeah, it's very prevalent in this one, and it works really well.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you guys are good, we can move on to form and aesthetic.
Well, I know we already touched on the you know, the beautiful cinematography and everything too. I wanted to say also that the sets in the movie are really well done, like especially the flooded mine shaft. I think you know, there's a kind of set piece fairly early on in the movie where you know, there's already been some attacks and they're just kind of trying to figure out what's going on, and you know, some of the miners are going back into the flooded area of the mine shaft, and that's a tense and creepy scene, I think largely because of that setting, and just a great sequence. And also some of the things like the you know, kind of the caved in area where you see the Rodan hatch in the flashback later on and everything is another really great set too. Very good production design in this movie.
Yeah, in that scene, I love how it plays with scale with the hatchling Rodan, and then you see it picking up the Mega Nulon and it's eating them, and then you go, oh my god, this Rodan baby is enormous. Because in the previous scene, the Mega Nulon, you know, we're on Sahara's level, so they were huge. Now they're on Rodan's level and they're tiny. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was really effective.
That's such a great way of elevating the stakes too, because it's like we've already seen the, you know, the devastation that the Mega Nulon can cause early on in the movie, and now you're seeing like, oh my god, this thing is eating those. Like,
yeah, there's something bigger.
Yeah, and so yeah, like you said, to get the scale of that is just a great visual representation. You know, everything's gone crazy.
Yeah, I feel like there's another good example of that, and it's kind of like more model sets than like, you know, human size sets, but still obviously related to set design. But excuse me, it's the moment when like there's an earthquake, which is supposed to be like kind of like a mild earthquake, but like we see the earth kind of like implode on itself. It's a really gorgeous moment and like kind of scary, because it's, you know, we don't know what's going on obviously, and it's like supposed to be like a Richter scale zero, like the earthquake expert is like, oh, it's a very minor earthquake, but suddenly we see like, you know, just like these fields just like get sucked up, and it's like, yeah, you realize the scope of it. You realize that something weird is going on, even though we don't know exactly what it is yet. And it's a great way to build suspense early on.
Yeah, those fields collapsing in on themselves. I agree. Those are very impressive models, I suppose, or special effects. I wanted to talk about the camera work. It's something I notice in all of Honda's movies. It's very dynamic. The camera moves a lot. There's, of course, he has static shots, but there's a lot of pans on crowds. There's just a lot of like zooming in for this dramatic heightened effect of terror. It's not often that I actually pay attention to the way the camera moves when I watch a movie. It's a habit I'm trying to get more into. But man, Honda's camera moves and it's awesome.
Totally. There's a cool shot where it's like outside of like a window outside of the engineer's office. And it's like kind of moving laterally through like several different rooms. And I think it's like the engineers and some journalists are trying to like figure out what's going on. There's a lot of chaos and kind of just like a lot of commotion. And this shot just like moves laterally from left to right, from like one space to the next. Mm-hmm. It's a really striking moment. And probably took like a lot of time and a lot of planning to set up, but it's very effective.
Yeah, just one more example of elevating it a little bit more. It looks like the movie also makes, this is fun. This is, I think, where some campy elements come into the film. The use of jolt or shock with the sudden appearance of a Mega Nulon. Like, you're not expecting it. I guess a jump scare in modern vocabulary. But yeah, it's just like, oh, shoot, there's a giant bug monster right there in the wall.
Yeah, and the way it comes into the movie is so great too, because up till that point you really haven't seen a monster or anything. They do a lot with just kind of building tension, you know, with just kind of hinting at what might be happening, and just kind of giving you like these, you know, creepy things happening in dark shadows or just out of frame or whatever. And then yeah, all of a sudden this giant like centipede type creature is just bursting through the doors of these people's home.
That's such an awesome moment. I love that when we first see the monster and it's like, yeah, in this domestic space where we like least expect it. It's so effective. I love it.
Yeah. And Frank, I'm glad you brought up the mystery aspects leading up to the reveal of our first monster, at least. And that's what I love about this movie. Like, you have the kaiju action towards the end with the Rodans, but in the beginning, it's a mystery. It's a murder mystery at first. The clues slowly unfold and build upon each other. So then when you get to the Mega Nulon and then you get to Rodan, it's like, wait, where did we start? what a thrill ride, really. A slow burn to get to the monster action that we expect.
Yeah, and I feel like the Rodan hatching sequence is a really good example of that too, because Shigeru can't remember what happened. And then in the hospital room, Kyo shows him like these eggs that her pet birds have lain, and that like, you know, conjures his memory. And there's this incredible scene, I love it, where, you know, he flashes back to when he's in the cave and he sees Rodan hatch from the egg, one of the Rodans. And it's both a good example of like the jolt or the shock, because we've seen like bits and pieces of Rodan during some of the like aerial combat scenes where some of the planes are knocked down, but not really very well. So like, this is the first time that we get a good look at this monster, and it just like emerges from this shell. It's really effective. And also it's a good example too of what you were talking about, Vincent, like the camera movement, because there's the character of Shigeru and like the camera sort of like zooms up to him very quickly, or maybe tracks up to him. I think it might be a tracking shot, but in any case, like, it definitely conveys, like, you know, obviously his shock at seeing this happen, and even like the shock of him like recovering this memory a little bit, you know.
Yes,
great scene. I love it.
I'm going to talk about that scene, how I feel about that scene, in my good breakdown. Cause
I didn't mean to take away your thunder. Sorry.
No, it's we could have a whole, I could talk about that one scene for 50 minutes.
Incredible. Yeah. This is such like a tightly constructed movie. Like, the plot really is all about the Rodan creatures. And like, even the human stuff is like totally focused on that. It's pretty much all about the miners that are, you know, killed by the Rodan creatures, or like the Mega Nulons, which I think is in contrast to some of the other kaiju movies where the humans have their own subplots, which maybe is not super interesting sometimes. Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that up because this movie is totally focused on Rodan, on those two creatures. And there's really not like an excess or like filler moment in the entire thing, in my opinion, maybe a few here and there.
Yeah, that's one thing I really like about this movie in comparison to a lot of other kaiju movies is there's really no, you know, there's no distractions from the matter at hand, really, so, which, you know, helps keep that sense of urgency up, but also just, you know, there's no aliens, there's no yeah. Like I don't know, there's no like cute stuff in it for kids or whatever. It's right. Just it's all very focused. And I think, you know, also by just not having anything there for the kids or any like silly stuff or whatever, it kind of doesn't dissipate the weirdness the way it does, I think, in some other kaiju movies. Like the fact that it has a more serious tone, you know, while still being something where you've got guys in the rubber suits and everything, makes it to me more bizarre and more surreal and more interesting.
I think it's that contrast between the bizarre and the seriousness of the other elements. And that line can get blurred in, like, you know, in other kaiju films, but in this, it's like we have our established world and it gets turned on its head by these bizarre elements.
Yeah. You know, like I do like Ghidorah. We were talking about this before a little bit, and I find like the human subplots like pretty amusing and like very, like I'm glad they exist in that movie, but I think like, yeah, like this and Ghidorah are like maybe equally good in my opinion, but in like completely different ways, you know, this movie's trying to do something totally different than that movie's trying to do.
Yeah. And I think Honda does both. He plays very well in both sandboxes.
Yeah.
If you guys are good, just going to our breakdowns.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Cool. I love two things. I really love the beginning of this movie when we're establishing this mystery. And that mystery is enhanced by Ifukube's score, which is unlike any other score I've heard of his. It's very foreboding and tense. And eerie, and it adds a lot to that sense of, well, foreboding, really. And then I do love the cave scene with Rodan. That whole scene when Shigura is seeing the hatchling, he just, the way it's framed and the way it's shot, there's like even like a wind effect, like blowing his hair a little bit. It's so epic and terrifying. Personally, it's one of the most incredible scenes I've ever seen in any movie.
For me, as far as the good, I mean, we've already talked about the great pacing and the plotting and the great production values and everything. I would say too, just how like genuinely eerie the movie is, I think is really impressive. Like we were talking about, I mean, even before the monsters show up, just like, you know, when they're going into those mine shafts, you know, gives you that great, you know, don't go in there type of feeling that you want to get out of horror movies every once in a while. So that aspect of it's great. There's a number of really good set pieces in here. I agree with you, Vincent, that the highlight is the Rodan hatching sequence. And that kind of reminds me a little bit of the, you know, there's the famous scene in the original version of The Fly, the 1950s version, right at the end with the protagonist being caught in that spider's web and, the, you know, the help me sequence. And it's just that's similar kind of just like nightmare of no longer being at the top of the food chain, you know,
Ooh.
And just being totally, totally helpless.
Yeah.
And that's just such a great version of that type of scene. Yeah, again, the thing with the Mega Nulon going crazy early on and just causing complete chaos, I think is a great, great sequence too. Yeah, and even the big kind of kaiju moments toward the end where the Rodans are kind of, they've gone into Fukuoka and they're attacking the city and getting attacked by the tanks and everything, and everything is smoky and, you know, from all of the gunpowder or whatever, is just a great version of that type of sequence as well.
Yeah, totally agree. I love the connection with The Fly. That's an awesome comparison and didn't really think about that, but that is totally true. I love that as well. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what both of you already said. I would add like the scenes of like aerial combat, maybe a little bit dated in a way, but in like a really beautiful sort of like very careful and like carefully crafted way. Like the scenes where the pilots are like trying to follow Rodan and they're like flying in its contrails, like it's sort of like jet stream or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Unexpectedly very beautiful. Love the sort of destruction scenes like you talked about, Frank. And yeah, just like the, it's a very entertaining movie, but also like the seriousness of it and the sort of the fact that it's like clearly a product of its time and place, you know, like it's trying to deal with like human anxieties and like concerns in the immediate post-war era, especially in Japan, is really admirable. And it does that while also sort of crafting this extremely intense and eerie monster movie. It's very impressive.
It does so many things so well together. It was hard finding some bad things for me, some things that didn't work. I'm really nitpicking here. Like you say, Matt, with the I agree that the aerial footage, he like the editing or whoever, they combine like real footage, like aerial footage with clear props, airplane props against a blue backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really well for me. With that said, yeah, you can see strings. You can tell that the cardboard props are a little too stiff. But whatever, like it's still done really well, in my opinion. With that said, I think the Mega Nulon creatures, as well crafted as those costumes are, they do come off rather silly for me. And there were some editing things in the beginning, like some, not even just transitions, like within one scene, you would see a little jump cut or something that was like, oh, maybe they were just trying to fix a mistake or something.
The one thing I had for the bad is that I feel like the revelation that there's a second Rodan should be a little more dramatic than, or really a lot more dramatic than it is in the movie, because the way it comes up is just kind of like, oh, there's a second one now. And it feels like there should be, it almost feels like there's like a scene missing or something where, you know, I don't know how they would establish this, but maybe like, okay, maybe they shoot the one down and the humans think that they've won or something. And then the second one pops up or something. Because the way it plays out is just kind of the second one just sort of shows up in the middle of the big battle toward the end. And then they're just like, oh, there's a second one. And it just feels a little undramatic for what that should be. And in what I think is otherwise a very well plotted and well structured movie.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't really have very much in the bad category either. It's hard to think of stuff to talk about here. I think, you know, I could almost use a little bit more of the destruction sequences, and that's like maybe a good and a bad thing, because that's not really like the main focus of the movie. Like, I feel like the payoff of like really only having the one scene in Fukuoka where like just it's chaos and like everything is destroyed. Like I feel like the movie kind of prioritizes the early scenes, which is almost more of like a horror movie where, mm-hmm. you know, there are these giant worms and like there's so much building of dread and suspense. It's not necessarily a bad thing that there aren't more destruction sequences, but like how amazing that single scene is in this movie makes me kind of want more of that, you know? But yeah. Then at the same time, it probably would be a little bit like excessive and would like sort of mess with the pacing of the movie a little bit. So,
which I think is the thing with movies that are as tightly constructed as Rodan, sometimes it's maybe a little too quick in its pacing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Like yeah. You could destroy one more city, you know, I'd be okay with that.
We're not going to not like the movie if you destroy one more city.
Exactly. Yeah.
Campy was actually even harder for me to figure out. There's a scene with there's like a newlywed couple and they are taking a drive on their honeymoon to Mount Aso. I don't know why that's where they go for their honeymoon, but it sets them up perfectly to get killed by a Rodan. So that scene I think is meant to be a little incredulous. Like, what are they doing?
Yeah, like going to the crater of like a maybe soon to erupt volcano probably is not the best thing to do on your honeymoon.
Right.
Makes for some good wedding pictures though, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, for this section, I just had that the tanks toward the end are like extremely
fake looking, like, which it's not really a bad thing. It's you know, charming in a way, and doesn't really take away from those last scenes, in my opinion. But it's like very clear that they just went to like the toy store and bought some toy things there.
Yeah, and painted the Japanese flag on them. I noticed that too.
Yeah. Also, I know you guys said that you like the flight sequences, and I don't think they're horrible or anything, but Rodan's flight, like the way that Rodan actually flies around, is pretty like stiff and silly looking too, I think.
Yeah, no, but you're not again, wrong. It's very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would just add one campy moment, which is sort of close to the beginning when like three or four miners are like going into the flooded mine to figure out what's going on. And one of them dies and they're like sort of dragged underwater, but yeah, they're not really dragged. They sort of just like slowly kind of like sink underwater while they're screaming in a very like not, you know, unconvincing way.
That's true.
that's the campiest moment to me.
Yeah, good point.
I agree, although I do think that scene is like genuinely creepy at the same time. Maybe it's just my own fear of being like dragged underwater by something I can't see or something. but yeah, that is, his acting is a little bit silly in that moment.
Maybe that just adds to the the disconcerting nature of it. Who knows?
Yeah. Matt, do you want to do your favorite part?
Sure. Yeah. So our categories are: it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Below that, we have there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and does stand the test of time. Thirdly, we have it may be historically significant or just fun, but does not stand the test of time. And last and least, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
Well, yeah, I'm going to give it the highest rating. The timeless classic stands the test of time. I mean, like I kind of said at the top, but, you know, I'd put this right up there with, you know, the original Godzilla and original King Kong as far as giant monster movies go. I think it's right up there with those. So definitely one of my favorites in the genre.
Well said. I also think it's a classic. I think it stands the test of time. I think its themes of global warming are so ahead of its time, and that message is conveyed through such disconcerting dread and horror. I think you could watch this movie time and time again and never get tired of it.
Yeah, totally agree. This is the first time that three of us all are going to give this the highest rating. It's a timeless classic. It's an amazing movie. It's also one of my favorites that I've seen in the kaiju genre. Yeah, and you know, in a nutshell, I would just say like the fact that it's able to make such a creepy, truly suspenseful horror slash monster movie while still conveying some pretty fascinating and you know, pretty serious minded themes is really impressive. Great work by pretty much everybody involved with this movie. Yeah, one of the best that we've talked about so far.
And great work to us tonight. That was great. Great conversation. And we're gearing up for next month. We have a couple movies lined up. Matt, do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, well, I know Frank will be joining us at the end of August for Shin Godzilla, which I'm very excited about. Ooh. I have never seen that before. Sounds great. Frank, did you want to say anything about that as sort of like a preview?
Yeah, just that was one I actually hadn't heard of until all of a sudden my brother asked me if I wanted to go see it. And, you know, it had like a one night screening in Milwaukee. We went to see it and it was really cool, really interesting movie, kind of an interesting throwback to the old Toho style, even though it's a newer movie.
You're in for a treat. I think just as good as Shin Godzilla will be our next episode. We are featuring the 1995 90s classic Mighty Morphin Power Rangers the movie with guest host Armando Rivera. If he's listening to this, you better not back out, because now it's official. It's gonna be a good campy time. Frank, thank you so much. We'll see you next month. How exciting.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, everybody, for hanging out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, please tell all your friends about it. Please leave us a rating and a review. You You can also follow us on Instagram, TikTok. Go ahead and check out CampKaijuMovieReviews.com. Oh, and before I forget, BanditsEmporium.com is, of course, the t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. You can find all sorts of monster-inspired t-shirts, like I said, anything from vampires to Frankensteins to your favorite kaiju. So give them some love. Helping them directly supports this show. So again, more than anything, we appreciate your help and support. And until next time, stay campy.
When he moves, the whole earth quivers and quakes, and an abyss of horror opens up. See these prehistoric beasts emerge from the bowels of the earth after 200 million years to devastate mankind.